This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm your host, Bill Radke. Is the city of Seattle headed in a new direction with a new senior deputy mayor? That's one news item we'll discuss as we cover what happened this week. As we do, I've got my panel of journalists with me, political analyst and contributing columnist Joni Balter. Welcome back.
Hi there.
Publicola co-founder and editor Erica Barnett. Welcome back, Erica.
Thanks, Bill.
And the author of the Wild West newsletter on Substack, and also the Gates Scholar at the UW School of Law, Eli Sanders. Good to see you again.
Nice to be back, Bill.
Yeah, nice to have you. Let's discuss what happened this week. Investigators are trying to figure out what happened to an ocean submersible built by an Everett company. The vessel was carrying its pilot and four paying passengers toward the wreckage of the Titanic when it imploded, killing all five people aboard. The pilot was Stockton Rush, the founder and CEO of that Everett company, Ocean Gate Expeditions. Rush had been pretty open about not adhering to all the industry standards for deep diving crafts. Joni, we'll start with you. What's the lesson?
Oh, my. What's the lesson? Well, I want to start by saying, you know, first and foremost, big condolences to the family and of all these folks. I mean, what a tragedy. The one thing I read that just really stayed with me is that the 19-year-old Pakistani traveler was terrified of this trip, didn't want to go, but because it was Father's Day and his dad was pressuring him, agreed to go. So that just kind of, as for the lesson, I mean, there are so many lessons and even more questions here if you think about it. You know, why didn't the folks at the company Ocean Gate, why didn't they listen to some of their critics? You should always listen to people who actually worked for you and saw problems and documented them, because they will can come back to haunt you. Why not listen to that? There was even a trade group that raised concerns. But, you know, sometimes folks are just such a hurry to go do the adventure.
Yeah. I should say, to let listeners know, a former Ocean Gate Expeditions employee sued them 5 years ago, claiming that the company ignored warnings that this vessel, the Titan, was potentially unsafe. He was subsequently fired.
That's correct. So there were suits and countersuits. But, you know, there were several folks who said you really have to check the integrity of the vessel to make sure it can withstand that huge amount of pressure. And I just think
more than once.
And, you know, sort of a we know better, which is, you know, never good when you're, you know, I don't want to just sit here and blame these folks, because we actually don't know the answer to exactly what happened.
That's right.
But I think we can ask tons and tons of different questions.
Yeah.
Another, you know, like, you know, why not take another safety check? Why not talk to a few more people? Yeah. But hindsight's really good at that, as you all know. And so you just want to be careful you don't sort of do that. One other thing that I just find, you know, shivers down the back is the story of the CEO's wife. Her name is Wendy Rush. And, you know, it's been reported a couple places that her great-great-grandparents perished on the original Titanic. And they, of course, were going down to see the ship. That ocean pressures are making it harder and harder to be able to see that, because less of it will be left. Mm-hmm. I just find that, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Erica, what did you take away here?
I mean, my takeaway was that this is just such a story of hubris. The CEO of, we don't need to know the full outcome of the investigation to know that the CEO said that, you know, innovation is, you know, regulation is the enemy of innovation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we don't need a bunch of 50-something-year-old guys around like himself. We need a lot of young innovators. And that, you know, that if he succumbed to the regulatory state like everybody else, he wouldn't be able to do these exciting expeditions. And, you know, I mean, I thought immediately of Elon Musk's rockets, you know, exploding in midair. And, you know, those aren't we're not putting people into, you know, outer space on those rockets yet. But I think that there's a, you know, a lesson that Musk and people like that probably won't take, that, you know, people, expertise is valuable and experience is valuable, and listening to the people who know what the hell they're talking about is actually important. And when you're putting people's lives at risk, as this, you know, CEO knew he was doing or had to have known, you know, it's hard to, I don't know, it's just, it's hard for me to muster a ton. I have a tremendous empathy for their families, but it's hard to muster a ton of empathy for someone who, you know, who knew he was putting people at risk and said that the, you know, reward, the adventure, the adrenaline was more important.
This week, even after this accident, a co-founder of this Everett company, OceanGate Expeditions, told the BBC that technology and innovation can outpace regulation, that developers are in a better position to understand and minimize risks, and that anyone who operates in the deep ocean, quote, knows the risk of operating under such pressure, and that any given moment you run the risk of this kind of implosion. Eli, what were your thoughts?
Well, we hear that argument all the time from industries that don't want to be regulated. That's the argument being made by tech companies about AI right now, that they understand it better than regulators in DC. That was an argument made about social media, just to bring up some current examples. And we've seen some of the outcomes when industry keeps regulators at arm's length. In this case, you have a person who was the speculation is that he was intentionally selling these trips in international waters in part to avoid regulation. He obviously had a feeling about regulation hindering innovation. And, you know, from my perspective, that's his right. But when he's selling tickets, expensive tickets, $250,000 to go down there, you do have some responsibility to your clients. And then there's also...
I should say, we don't know that these passengers didn't know everything that Rush knew about skirting industry standards and all that. I don't know.
And there's been a lot of reporting about the long, I think the quote was like toe-curling release that you have to sign.
The waivers.
Yeah.
But the other piece of this is the expense of the search and the effort to respond to this disaster, which, you know, by a lot of accounts was predictable. And so, you know, when you have an innovator saying, government, get out of my way, I know best, I'm going to go and do these tours, even though I'm being told by industry and, well, at least the industry and maybe regulators too, that they're dangerous or the equipment needs to be certified. And then when things go horribly wrong, tragically wrong for everyone involved, the government is on the hook for the expense of responding. Is that fair?
Well, and there's, you know, this has been pointed out a lot. This is not, you know, an original observation by me, but, you know, you compare that to the tragedy in which, you know, hundreds of migrants died off the coast of Greece. And, you know, Greece sort of, you know, washed its hands of it. And, you know, it does begin to feel as if, you know, the billionaires' lives have more value than the lives of these migrants who died, including all the women and children on board that ship.
Yeah, I got an email along those lines from a listener who said, where's the urgency to make that trip safer? Yes, Joni.
No, I was just simply going to say that, you know, I while we do this, we should also remember that, you know, it's part of our nature to want to be adventurers and want to explore. And yet all these questions that we're asking are totally fair game. Who pays for it? You know, you avoided the regulations, but then you called the same governments in to, you didn't directly call, you couldn't, but
I wonder if he could have said, look, I know what I'm doing, I'm not going to follow the rules, and don't bother searching.
This is one thing that occurred to me last night. I was thinking about this kind of balance sheet that people are doing in the wake of this, that, you know, you got to avoid regulation, but the government had to pick up the tab for the mess. And maybe that's an alternative in the future, that the owner of this service and everyone who takes him or her up on it says, you know, not only am I signing this huge release, but I also expressly say that I don't want any taxpayer-funded entity to come to my rescue.
How about people who ski in the back country of the Cascades?
Well, also, I was just going to say, this comes up in when mountaineers who are not experienced go up to Mount Rainier. You know, they just arrived from some other place. Maybe they did or didn't understand the challenges. But then, you know, taxpayer-funded entities have to go in, helicopters, this, that, small planes, to kind of rescue these folks. So we really do need to kind of figure that out. Maybe that's a solution. Sign away. Add another page.
Well, I mean, I think
add another
I think
page to the toe
way
curling.
That way lies chaos, and you know, and the ultimate libertarian state. And in you know, if we actually were to implement that sort of thing, I mean, we do have a moral obligation to try to, you know, to save lives. But it would be in an ideal world, we would apply that moral obligation equally to all lives that are at risk, including those of migrants who we, you know, lock up in jail. But I do think that having people sign a waiver, I mean, I sign stuff all the time online. It's much more trivial. But, you know, did they look at and consider, especially a 19-year-old, consider the true implications of every single word of that waiver?
Well, that's the one of the things that bothers me the most. Did you all see what Titanic director James Cameron said about this?
He said a bunch. What stood out to you?
Well, I'm sort of, you know, hung up between this connection of now and historically. And he said I'm struck by the similarity of the Titanic disaster itself, where the captain was repeatedly warned about ice ahead of his ship, and yet he steamed at full speed into an ice field. And this company was warned. Steam full speed down as far as they got.
One more thing I wanted to bring up here, and speaking of stuff we don't know, a lot of local engineers are distancing themselves from this vessel. OceanGate had said on its website that its engineers worked with Boeing and the University of Washington Applied Physics Lab, and that those engineers made significant contributions to the Titan's design and construction. But the UW and Boeing are denying that. They're saying, well, we worked on
earlier
versions, yeah. You know, a submersible that was designed for a much shallower depth that has plied Puget Sound, Salish Sea, et cetera. So I think there'll be a lot of questions. You know, it's not those lines are not necessarily so clear. And you heard James Cameron again. I don't know everything. I don't know the engineering specs, right? But he was criticizing just the carbon fiber construction of a hull that was going to face repeated pressure, ocean depth pressures that is not faced by flying vehicles. And so how much did local engineers, you know, who all sort of designed or signed off on the wisdom of this design? We're going to be hearing a lot about that.
And so that pressure was described as the weight of an elephant on a finger. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of pressure.
Anything to add? Do we cover it for now?
Just on your question of who signed off, I think that person perished in the implosion, it sounds like.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it only takes one, it only takes one libertarian, I'll say, who hates the regulatory state to decide, you know, that a fatal flaw will not actually be fatal.
Yeah. And I guess I should add that, the fact that there I wouldn't be surprised if there are people listening who knew Stockton Rush, worked with these people, they live in Seattle, they work in Seattle. It doesn't change the journalistic questions we're bringing up about regulation or design or any of that. But I imagine there's some real heartbroken people, including people listening to us now, discuss this. What you call a tragedy, Joni, and that word is very overused. Sometimes it's just when something sad happens. But I don't know, the motivations and fascinations and parallels here, I think, actually qualify it for tragic in some senses.
Absolutely. You know, the company is now has a sign on it up in Everett that says closed indefinitely.
Right.
I mean, this is about as local as you can get here.
Yeah. And I just want to say, I don't mean to diminish the tragedy. I mean, as I said, I think we have a moral obligation as a society to try to save people in situations like this when we can. I just think that, you know, there is an ideology at play here that that played into why this happened. And I think that, you know, it's kind of our job as a society to examine that and say, maybe we need to have more of a regulatory state when it comes to things that are so life and death and that you can, you know, die in an instant. I mean, there was a description, if a you know, the fraction of a hair of, you know, a drop of water gets in, that's it.
Yeah.
So the risk was so incredibly high.
And, you know, when you're talking about the eternal spirit of adventure, essentially, and that people have done heedless things all the time, and sometimes they go okay, and we praise them for it. The other part of that is when they don't go well, we learn from it. And so that can be something here, too, that if this was done outside of regulations in that kind of eternal spirit of adventure, you know, risks aside, then there's something probably for people to learn for future adventures about what went wrong here.
Yeah. And that's a part of our lots of cities, but really the Seattle area, that engineering, pioneering, risk taking for better or for worse. It's a real part of this town.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. You're listening to Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with my panel of journalists here, Erica Barnett, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. And so we're discussing what happened this week and what it means. Before we take a break, I want to bring in this lawsuit that suggests that Amazon, quote, tricked and trapped its customers into buying Prime memberships. This is what the Federal Trade Commission alleged this week when it sued Amazon for allegedly deceptive practices, as KUOW's Monica Nicholsberg told us.
The FTC charged Amazon with enrolling customers in its Prime subscription without their consent. The complaint also claims Amazon intentionally made it difficult for customers to unsubscribe from Prime. Amazon is also under investigation by the Senate Labor Committee for worker safety issues in its warehouses. A spokesperson for the company called both the lawsuit and the investigation baseless.
Eli Sanders, how did Amazon allegedly trick and trap people?
A couple of ways, according to the FTC complaint, which was filed in the Western District of Washington here this week. So one way was by having people sign up for Prime kind of against their will or without their knowledge, by making signing up for Prime a part of the process to just like check out when you're buying something from Amazon as not a Prime member. Or another example is making people think that they needed Prime in order to get Prime Video, which is not the case. You can actually, I didn't even know this.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, you can get just Prime Video, but Amazon's website and a lot of the features on it, the FTC alleges, made people think that they needed to buy the more expensive Prime, which then automatically renews and Amazon makes a lot more money that way. So that was one way. The other way was when you try to get out, when you've got Prime, or Prime's got you, depending on how you see it, and you try to get out, you go into this process that the FTC described and even Amazon employees described as the Iliad process.
Yeah, that was their internal name for it.
Right.
I love that they're making fun of their own customers. That's not nice.
So the Iliad process, the Iliad is a reference to a very long epic poem by Homer about, you know, a very long war, just to sum it up. And a lot of adventures along the way. The point to Amazon seems to have been that the Iliad is long. And so is the Iliad process. So if you're trying to get out of Prime membership, according to the FTC complaint, it takes you, you know, multiple different pages, multiple different clicks.
It's a real odyssey.
Complete odyssey.
I think they might have got their Homer reference slightly off.
I'm with you, Bill. I think it should have been the odyssey. And I think the reference from the Odyssey that's kind of analogous would be the sirens. Like once you've heard Amazon's call, that's it. You can't get out. What I like most from the FTC complaint is the description of some of the tools that Amazon allegedly used to keep people from getting out. So, and to get them in. So there's forced action where the interface kind of forces you to sign up for Prime before you can buy something else. There's interface interference, where like if you're on a smartphone and you're trying to scroll down to see the terms, you can't do it easily. Or when you're trying to hit the button that says I don't want Prime or I want to move past this, it's so close to the buy Prime button that your thumb is going to hit the buy Prime button instead. Then there's obstruction, or, and this is from the complaint, it's otherwise known as the Roach Motel technique. And this is just where like there's things everywhere trying to distract you or move you away from getting out of Prime. Misdirection, sneaking. But this is my favorite, confirm shaming.
confirm shaming.
So this is where, on your Iliad process or the Odyssey, I agree is a better term, you come to a page that says, we just want to confirm that you really want to leave Prime. And we would like you to remember all the good times you've had with Prime.
Are you quoting?
I'm paraphrasing, but I'm describing something that's in the complaint, and there's screen grabs of this. Mm-hmm. And it shows you, you know, for example, how many hours of Prime you've recently watched or how much Prime music you've listened to. Mm-hmm. And it's allegedly meant to kind of shame you.
What kind of person are you?
Right.
Who cancels their membership?
We had this long relationship, and now you're leaving me. Think of all the good times.
Yeah.
Never mind that it was a service that this person was paying for, and now they want to end it. Plus, the complaint alleges there's all kinds of sort of tricks in ending it where you are not easily able to end it on the day that you want to end it, but get charged for the whole month, things like that.
So a couple things. I am super glad the FTC is looking into this. You outlined a whole bunch of things that are just weird and not okay. I don't like the single button. So you're left. It's a single button to make the buy, but then that in some cases signs you up for Prime. So how many of us have gone, do I go up? Do I go down? Where is the other button that doesn't do that? So I find that just worth the FTC's consideration. That said, yesterday I canceled Prime. Five clicks. Five clicks is what it took. They never told me what a great time we had, but I saw the language saying, you know, you can't, you know, it'll be really difficult for you if you do this. I mean, that wasn't the exact wording, but that's how I read it. But anyway, five clicks and I was out. So they may or may not have changed it overnight. I do not know, since the FTC sort of notified them. Try it. I'll show you the receipt.
Yeah, well, the FTC complaint does say that Amazon did change it right before the lawsuit was filed, and that the FTC had been investigating Amazon, and Amazon knew this for, I think, a year or more previous. So the FTC alleges that Amazon made some changes in response. I did find the confirm shame page screen grab. So it says, thank you for being a member with us. Take a look back at your journey with Prime.
Oh, no.
And then
we're in trouble.
Right. Think about the journey. And then it talks about the TV shows that you've watched and the songs that you've listened to and the number of packages that were shipped. And then you get these choices for buttons. And one is remind me later, which, you know, you're just feeling guilty and you say, okay, I'll give this a pause. And it takes you out of the Iliad process and then you'd have to start it over. Or keep my benefits, which sounds good. And then in the middle, continue to cancel, which I think takes you to another step in the process.
So it's great if they get Amazon to stop doing this practice. But I think, you know, the larger issue is this happens in all sorts of consumer experiences. It's not just Amazon being the bad guy. I mean, they are the bad guy here. But I mean, I think about like trying to, you know, change a subscription that I have for a large podcast sponsored consumer product that arrives every month. And it's quite like that. It's like, you know, are you sure you don't want our product? Like, maybe you just want to like pause it for a month. And I always end up pausing it for a month. And I've been doing that for about a year. I've had a magazine subscription recently. Or I'm sorry, no, the Criterion Channel. I'll name it. It's impossible. You cannot. You just have to dispute it on your credit card.
That always gets me when they want to know.
Amazon definitely.
No. There's no process. You have to email them, and then they don't email you back. There's no phone number. It's literally like you send an email into the ether, and it doesn't come back, and you keep paying.
Wow. But to be clear here, Amazon does ask you, what's the reason you're leaving?
Right. But I'm just saying, like, this is like also, I mean, another example is a newspaper that I tried to cancel. No, not the Seattle Times, the Houston Chronicle. And apparently, like, I looked up examples of this, and this is apparently a big Texas problem, but I assume it's a problem everywhere. It is, you have to call, you have to like sit in a call center, wait for, you know, 77 minutes or whatever, talk to a person, and then they try to talk to you out of it for another 17 minutes. So I think this is a universal problem with things that you sign up for that are subscription based, and it's so frustrating. And there obviously needs to be some kind of blanket regulation, you know, beyond just sanctions on Amazon, because man, this is happening all across the consumer spectrum.
And Erica, I think you flagged this in our pre-show discussion, but the FTC is working on a rule right now, the click to cancel rule.
Yep.
And so it's a proposed rule making its way through the regulatory process, but it's meant to address exactly this problem.
And it's so baffling to me that companies, you know, especially companies that are like selling you a subscription to I subscribe to a lot of magazines still, you know, a newspaper, something that is not like, you know, once a year expensive thing. It produces such ill will in me to that company forever. And I don't forget. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to subscribe to this Condé Nast product because I know they're going to make it really hard for me to get out of.
So when they send you the confirm shaming page and they're like, let's reflect on the journey.
It makes me furious.
You have a few things to say about the journey.
I also have goodwill for companies that make it easy. And so, I mean, it's baffling to me that companies don't seem to care at all about that, because I'm sure I'm not the only person that has that experience.
Yeah.
This may sound weird, but what this reminds me of is, do you remember when we learned that Jeff Bezos, the former CEO of Amazon, did not pay federal income tax? And I just thought to myself at the time, yeah, I'm sure that Jeff Bezos can afford the lawyers who can tell him, you don't have to pay any federal income tax. But why would you do that? Why would you let that come out? And in this case, why would you make fun of your customers? Why would you challenge customers? This company is thriving. I mean, it's not doing as well as it once did, but I don't think they need to play tricks to have customers buy Prime. Why get caught at it?
And some of what you're saying comes through in the FTC's complaint that they filed, where the FTC actually says specifically Amazon had in-house and out-of-house counsel who are very familiar with FTC rules and regulations working on this. This should have gone a different way. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. Why put us through the Trojan War? Maybe it's because being an Amazon Prime member is predestined by Zeus. That, like, Achilles was fated to kill Hector, and you are fated to get a Toshiba 50-inch TV for only $249.
We can't understand
these forces.
In 3 to 5 hours.
All right, we should take a break. that question of, like, why are you leaving? I hate that question, because I know if I can't just say, I don't like it, because then it'll come back and say, well, what do you mean you don't like it? Well, I didn't use it. Well, why don't you use it then? That would solve that.
It's like the worst breakup ever.
Not with a temporary 10% off, it isn't. Yeah, yeah. Just, I'm breaking up with you. Just hold your head high. Move on.
It is you.
It is you.
And okay. It's me.
All right. Let's. We also could talk about Amazon when it comes to another closure of an Amazon Go store. I feel I need to take a break. Maybe we'll take up Amazon Go when we talk about the city in general. What direction is the city headed of Seattle, that is, after we take a break on Week in Review, and come right back.
You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community. And we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. Did I mention we're streaming the show on YouTube and Facebook? Because we're charismatic, physically. I think we're handsome, and so that you can see another dimension of the show if you just search KOW Public Radio on Facebook or YouTube, and you will see Eli Sanders, author of the Wild West newsletter on Substack. You'll see Publicola's Erica Barnett and political analyst Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. Yeah, they just waved to you. There you go. Thank you. You've all waved. This week, the office of Seattle's mayor told the Seattle Times that the city's senior deputy mayor is leaving. Monisha Harrell had been a court-appointed monitor of the police department's federal oversight. She was appointed to the senior deputy mayor job by her uncle, Mayor Bruce Harrell. Erica, why is Monisha Harrell leaving, and what does it say about city policy on some big, controversial issues?
Well, I think there's always been conflict within the mayor's office between I'm just going to use her first name to distinguish the Harrells.
Yeah.
So Monisha's faction and the sort of Tim Burgess, former city council member Tim Burgess, who is, you know, much more of a law and order kind of guy, somebody who thinks of jail as part of the criminal legal system that we should be utilizing to, you know, with drug dealers, drug users. And so, you know, we've seen a few things happen. I mean, one is that the city ended its relationship with community court. That was the city attorney's decision. But I think that it is likely that Monisha Harrell was not a fan of that decision.
Community court is a therapeutic court for low-level offenders.
Correct. Yeah. It basically was a court that allowed people to be jailed and then released without charges and to do a pretty, simple program. To get out of charges for minor things like drug crimes, for low-level drug crimes. And, I think right now the city is debating this law that would, you know, that would make it a gross misdemeanor at the local level, allow the police to start arresting people for misdemeanor, public drug use, and simple possession of drugs. The mayor's put together a task force to sort of figure out what to do about this. But I think there's a lot of conflict there there has been a lot of conflict internally. And now Tim Burgess is going to be taking Monisha Harrell's position, essentially, probably with a slightly different portfolio. And so that's, you know, that is who is ascendant in what point of view is ascendant at the mayor's office.
I would just like to say from the 20,000 foot level, this whole change in the mayor's office is kind of duh. You know, mayors have honeymoons. Mayor Bruce Harrell has had an incredibly long honeymoon. It's something like 18 months. It is common, I think, from observing many, many other mayoralties, that you'd sometimes have a shakeup in your staff, in your deputy mayors. There are now four deputy mayors. There will be. I think there used to be three. And from my perspective, and I think the perspective of a lot of folks in Seattle, to have one of those be more of a, you know, we're really not talking about anybody being all sticks or all carrots, but I think, you know, you're just talking about sort of percentage or emphasis on carrots and sticks. And I think that the folks...
Are we talking about drug possession arrests? Are we talking about homeless encampments?
All of that. And let's go to the law that failed 5-4, and now there's a task force. Yawn. Task force has got to be one of the biggest stalling tactics for, you know, yeah, they'll produce something, but it's a stalling tactic. And so what I think on that vote, though, and this is really important, on that 5-4 vote, so... You know,
this is the city's vote not to empower the city's prosecutor's office
right.
to prosecute these drug possession
and drug use. So when they were talking about this law, I remember thinking, could they be a little clearer here about what they're actually trying to do? And so to me, there's a big difference between public drug use and individual possession. And they never really made a big deal. We're really after public drug use, which... a poll shows, has 60% support in the city of Seattle. So some of what this change at the top of the mayor's office, I know this sounds like sort of inside baseball for folks listening, but the
I do want listeners to know what's going to change.
I think it's emphasis again. I think after this task force wastes perhaps 5 weeks or however many weeks it's going to be, that there will be a bill to put some sticks in for public drug use. And I think folks in Seattle are there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first of all, the legislation also bans individual possession, and that is pointed. I mean, the legislation does not, the idea was that it incorporates this new state law that makes public drug use and possession a gross misdemeanor, but they didn't incorporate all of the law. They pointedly incorporated these two things. So possession is now a misdemeanor. If you have illicit drugs, you are committing a gross misdemeanor, and if you get caught, you can go to jail for up to 364 days. Now, that is unlikely, but
beyond unlikely.
But that is the maximal penalty. Mm-hmm. I think this task force, you know, I'm not so ready to write it off as a stalling tactic, simply because they have brought a lot of people who are on the ground and who have been very involved in doing this work. to the table, including people like Damon Shadid, the former judge at community court, which Ann Davison's office, you know, essentially ended. But he's at the table with the city attorney's office, with, you know, soon to be the public defender's office. And
I want to make sure we don't lose listeners in all these different players here. They want to know, is this the departure of this deputy senior mayor? And it sounds like the elevation of this former city councilor, who you're saying is a more of a law and order guy, in your words. What's going to change, or do we know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I do think that the stuff I mentioned before is definitely going to change. But I think, like, internally, and I'm sorry if this is a little bit inside baseball, but I think it matters. I think Moesha Harrell was really respected by departments, by department heads, by the city council, by everybody, because she was a listener, is a listener, as somebody who, you know, who would take back concerns, who would change her mind. And, you know, it is kind of, you know, a thoughtful administrator. And I'm not saying Tim Burgess is not that, but he can also be, you know, kind of a polarizing person. I mean, he's been a politician most of his life. And I think that, you know, he is not going to necessarily be someone who, you know, says, oh, you know what, I was wrong all along. And actually, we need to change course. I think he's got his priorities in place, and he's being elevated because of those priorities. I mean, the guy proposed making, you know, quote unquote, aggressive panhandling a crime when he was on the city council. I mean, these are pretty hardcore policies, you know, making designating areas as special drug emphasis areas, and, you know, and rounding up people in those, you know, hotspot areas. So, you know, a history of being very much more law enforcement oriented.
And as you told me, Monica, I'm sorry, Erica, requiring the changing the city charter to require all public spaces to be clear of encampments.
Yeah, he was behind the Compassion Seattle initiative that failed, or that never, you know, made it on the ballot. That would have done that. It would have required in the city charter that all public spaces be clear of encampments, and would have done some other stuff that Bruce Harrell has claimed that he has accomplished. So that is kind of the remaining. Now, I don't know that he's going to be in charge of that aspect. There's another deputy mayor, Tiffany Washington, who deals with homelessness. But it's a flag, whether you consider it a red flag or a green flag, just depends on your perspective.
By the way, I mashed up Moesha and Erica there. You're welcome.
I like it.
Anything else to add?
Well, I'm just curious, as someone who's not as into the nitty gritty of City Hall at the moment as Erica and Joni are,
and most of our listeners.
And most listeners. Okay. Well, hopefully I'm with most listeners, and wondering then whether this might signal a change in terms of more leadership rather than followership from the mayor's office on this issue. It seems like the council has been in the lead here with deciding whether or not they're going to follow the state law, with implementing this task force. Just as a, you know, avid consumer of news, I haven't heard Mayor Harrell saying much either way about what he wants. And so maybe this reshuffle of the deputy mayors under the actual mayor will lead to more actual proclamations, maybe, or leadership from the mayor about where he wants the city to go in response to crime and drug use and abuse and overdoses.
Well, so I think I want to get in here if I can. I think we have to look a little bit at the results in the city. Instead of sort of blaming people for individual things that we maybe did or didn't like, I think we have to talk about the results. And we have a shining, as in not shining, example in San Francisco. If you don't have public safety, you don't have a city. You don't have the money to pay for the services that the good people of Seattle often do pay for. Moesha Harrell is respected, but I will say, as a 15-year-old, I wrote in my personal journal, don't go into business with your family. Now, I had a family reason to say that, but why am I saying that so, you know, absolutely? Because when you disagree sometimes, it's harder, you know, to do that because of all the loaded stuff there. I believe that, you know, this change will, you know, to answer your question, Eli, one hopes that the mayor will sort of become clearer as he speaks about this. I think he wants to speak clearer. I think he's been trying to sort of balance between different forces and different ways of saying that Seattle does not want to become San Francisco. Seattle wants to deal with its public safety problem and, you know, its many other problems. And I think we should just kind of let it rip here a little bit so we can see, you know, let's all watch the mayor. What is he going to say differently? And just press onward with that.
Well, I think that the reason you're not hearing a lot of, you know, what you would call, like you said, leadership, but I think that the reason you're not hearing the mayor say, I want to fight the drug war, is because the mayor doesn't want to fight the drug war. And, you know, and I take him at his word, actually, when he says that. Now, I don't know that his actions are going to necessarily be commensurate with that. I think he may end up reigniting the drug war. But I think, you know, he really is conflicted on this, I think. And this is not because of some deep, like, you know, friendship I have with the mayor. It's just what he said and what I've heard about the way that he, you know, kind of feels about this stuff. So I think there's some conflict there that'll continue to play out that's not going to be resolved by Tim Burgess being deputy mayor.
Okay, we will watch. We've got to move on. We're talking about drug use, among other things, and that plays into this next topic. Erica, you reported that a Seattle police officer who drove into and killed a pedestrian in a South Lake Union crosswalk in January was driving 74 miles per hour right before he ran into this woman. SPD says he was responding to a 911 call. What's important here? Was the officer following police department rules? Who's getting the blame? What's this about?
Yeah, well, so there are a lot of rules around when you can, you know, go fast in response to an emergency. SPD has sort of changed the reasoning that they've said he was following a number of times. They said it was an overdose call, and then it was clear that it was, you know, and this report lays out exactly the details. You know, it was clear that it was a guy who was standing outside his apartment on the line with, you know, with 911 saying, you know, I'm freaking out because I think I took too much cocaine. So it wasn't that he needed to respond as an EMT to overturn reverse an overdose.
Did the officer, speeding officer, know that?
Well, according to the report, we do know that. You know, it said that he was informed, you know, initially what the situation was, then informed that you know, Seattle Fire was on the way, and then informed that the guy was staying on the line with 911 and was lucid and talking to them and waiting for people to show up. So. Okay. One could argue that he knew it wasn't a true emergency that would require going three times the speed limit on a 25-mile-an-hour street.
And not running his siren continually.
And chirping his siren at intersections, according to the report. But I think what's going to, you know, be more, you know, more a focus of the investigation is less what was in his mind and more, was he following policies and practices? So he's supposed to have his siren on. It's unclear that he did have his siren on. He is supposed to exercise reasonable due care in responding to emergency. And so the question is, does going 74 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone constitute due care? And was he looking? Because the fact is, I mean, by the time he had entered the previous crosswalk before the one in which he struck this young woman, her fate was sealed because he was going so fast at that point, he could not have slowed down. And he only braked for 2/3 of a second before striking her. And the report itself is quite grisly. And that's one reason I have not published it online. But, you know, it is a very sad story. And I'll say he's on leave. I think it's entirely conceivable, if not probable, that he'll be fired. And the case is now at the King County Prosecutor's Office.
Yeah, it's not up to the city. It's the decision to prosecute is in the King County Prosecutor's Office's hands.
But the city sent it to them.
Right.
Yeah, and so that was a decision by SPD.
I see.
To say, you know, we have, most likely they decided that they had probable cause. Oh. And so now it's in their hands.
Okay. So is there any takeaway? I guess it's too early to tell. I mean, are we saying that the system worked or the system didn't work or somewhere in between?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the system didn't work because somebody was hit and killed by a police officer driving way too fast and was killed in a crosswalk. So the system didn't work. But I think that, you know, if this officer is prosecuted, is fired, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's very hard for me to imagine an officer serving jail time. But regardless, I don't think this says a whole lot about the system, because I think that SPD can point at this person and say this was one bad apple. This was one bad actor. He was new to the force. He joined in, you know, 2020. And we've taken the right action, and it looks good for us. But I don't think that that says a whole lot about the system as a whole.
Okay.
I just want to say big congratulations to you, Erica, for breaking this story. It was literally nowhere else. So that's that independent local reporting.
Yes, thank
you. That we all seem to love and not able to pay enough for. So I have a question, though. And look, no cop wants to kill somebody while they're on the way to supposedly help somebody else. And I appreciated in the story you talked about our rules for, you know, for gunning the police car. But what do other cities do? Does anybody know that? Like, you know, how could we have a rule that's in place maybe somewhere else that would have prevented this? Because we're going to need to get to that.
I mean, I don't know the answer to the question about what other cities do, but I don't think that we are like out on the cutting edge on this, nor are we, you know, falling dangerously behind other cities, as far as I know, in terms of, you know, exercising due care. The problem is, you know, we need to define what due care is, and that is very hard to define, and it's all subject to police union negotiations. I mean, as everything is. So it is really a matter of changing policies and procedures if we want to prevent things from happening like this tragedy again.
Okay, we got to take a break again. I think the King County Prosecutor's Office is expected this summer to make a decision on whether to bring charges against this officer.
That's right. Should be soon.
Okay. KUOW's Week in Review, that's Erica Barnett with Eli Sanders and Joni Balter. We're going to take a short break and start steaming toward the end of this episode of Week in Review. Stick around. It's KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, a foundation released its annual report on child well-being, and the news site Axios Seattle noted that in Washington State, it costs more to put a toddler in daycare for a year than it does to pay a Husky student's tuition. That's a statewide average. Your child care costs may vary. Eli Sanders, I assume your conclusion is that child care workers are being paid too much money.
No.
Oh.
But as a parent, I did find this extremely upsetting and completely backwards. I mean, you should not be paying more to put your child through daycare at a time, you know, when your child is young. Most families are less financially stable or have less of a cushion than maybe when the child is older and ready to go off to college. Plus, you've had 18 years to potentially save for it. And so just the idea that it would be more expensive to pay for daycare than a year at the UW, it represents a very large systemic failure in my mind. It's not that child care workers are being paid too much, however. And, you know, in our pre-show discussion, it was pointed out the city of Seattle actually has been putting out, I'm not sure what they call it, a grant of some sort to child care workers to help retain them because it's so hard to keep child care workers. But that, again, is a system in failure, that the government has to come in and help private daycare entities pay their employees enough to keep them. And so I can't tell you all the failures that are leading to this, but we do often talk about, you know, failures of the free market and so on. This, I think, is a failure to intervene in the market in a way that makes sense for families and children. The reason that the University of Washington costs less than daycare is that the state subsidizes or pays for tuition at the University of Washington at a rate higher than it's subsidizing daycare. So maybe, as others have pointed out, we should take some of that money that's coming in through the capital gains tax, a more powerful gusher of money than anyone imagined, that's meant to go to education, maybe not childcare, but maybe some of it gets redirected at some point toward this problem, and the state can help make childcare as affordable as the University of Washington is.
Yeah, I mean, as the non-child haver.
Yeah, that's right. How do you feel about that?
You know, I mean, I think it's outrageous. I think that, you know, that the failure of the free market is that things like childcare should not be determined by the free market. I mean, it just should not be a free market question that, you know, childcare providers and parents have to decide amongst themselves, you know, who gets more screwed. I mean, that's just it's outrageous. I did want to you pointed out in our pre-show discussion that some Republicans are saying that taxpayers should give parents money and let them decide if they want to stay home with their kids.
That's right.
And, you know, I am all for women who take up, you know, who do the bulk of that work getting paid for their labor. I'm very surprised to hear that Republicans are on board with the idea of paying fair wages for housework, for, you know, for child care, for doing the laundry, for cooking the meals, for running all the errands, for being the admin for the entire house, for being the project manager. But if they are truly on board, then welcome to the party, friends.
I have no reason to be as tired as I am at the end of the day, apparently.
Indeed.
I like how you caught them in their own sort of like Iliad process there. Like, they clicked the button for Republicans funding, I think, at home schooling, and you got them to pay for
it. It was more Odysseus. Yeah. Odyssean, I meant to say.
Yes. Okay. Is there anything, I was going to say, anything being done about this? We've mentioned some things. There's some, the city of Seattle's making some more payments out of the Jumpstart tax.
Yep.
To child
Jumpstart
workers.
And COVID, before that, COVID ARPA funds.
Right,
yep.
Right. So you're not saying, Erica, hey, I chose not to have kids because they're expensive. Why should I pay my tax money so that other parents can not stay home with their kids?
I mean, I actually think that the lifestyle that I'm able to have, I should be subsidizing other people more.
Is its own reward?
I mean, in a way, like, yeah. Look, I'm not taking on a lot of the burdens of society by not having kids. And, you know, I think that that is something that I would much rather subsidize than a lot of the stuff that I pay taxes for.
Also, and I know this show has talked about this a lot, but early childhood education connects to all of the problems that we have been talking about for an hour here on the show, including crime and the drug abuse and overdose problem in the city right now. And so to the extent that children are well cared for and parents are well supported in children's early years, that benefits everyone for the child's lifetime and beyond.
That's absolutely true. I'm glad you pointed that out, because there really is a direct connection, and we should recognize that.
Making us sad right now, making us frown, making us frown right now is that we only have a minute left in the show. Is there anything making us smile, on the other hand?
Well, as I told you guys before, I have a curveball, which is a sports metaphor, I'm
Whoa.
Told. I am going to see the Ballard FC tonight, take on Ole Town, which I...
That sounds like soccer.
It is the American football.
Yes.
I'm going to see them at the Interbay Stadium tonight. I'm very excited about that.
All right.
So, I'll be a soccer expert the next time I come on your show, Bill.
Ballard FC. Okay. Good luck.
Making me smile is Pride this weekend and the weather, which looks great all weekend long.
Lovely.
Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg in a cage fight.
In a cage fight.
I am so into this. If it's real, I think it's a joke.
Yeah, they've been tweeting about physically fighting one another. It's too good to be true. Sure. Yeah.
Isn't Zuckerberg like an MMA fighter?
He's
himself?
A jiu-jitsu trained in some way. And to his credit, Musk said, I'm going to pull the walrus on him. My move is the walrus where I just lie down on top of my opponent, which I thought was kind of funny.
There was someone on Twitter who said, that finally is an Elon Musk offering that I would pay for.
Right. Okay, we got to go. Erica Barnett co-founded and edits Publicola. And Joni Balters, a political analyst and columnist. And Eli Sanders, besides being the Gates Scholar at the UW Law School, is the author of the Wild West newsletter on Substack. Thank you for being on the show. Great to see you all.
Thank you,
Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm Bill Radke. Thanks to our producer, Kevin Kniestet, and running the board, Bernard Ouellette. We're out of here. We'll talk to you again next week on Week in Review.